On episode 73 of the Green Street Hammers podcast, Henry, Jack and Aaron discuss the season finale against Aston Villa, and we dish out our own end of season awards. So welcome back to the Green Street Hammers podcast. It is 73. We are going to be analysing the whole season that's gone by, whether it's the player of the season, goal of the season, and much more. I'm Henry Tomlinson, going to be your host tonight, as Adam is still very much busy with his own things. I'm joined by Jack, nice to meet you, who is new to the Green Street Hammers. Jack?
Hi, pleasure to be here. Can't wait.
What have you been up to recently?
Not much, really. Just been a bit busy with just doing some jobs and stuff, but can't wait to get back to writing more.
And Aaron is back with us again. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing pretty well. We all know the news, West Ham staying up, which I think brightens everybody's days and weeks. And over here in Canada, life's kind of returning to our new normal. So I'm just adjusting to that. But yeah, I'm pretty well, thanks.
Well, I think we should best start the podcast off with a quick sort of match summary of the final day of the season, where we got a good 1-1 draw, or good or bad, whatever way you see it, against Aston Villa as they confirmed their place in the Premier League. What were your highlights, Aaron, from the match?
To be honest, my son was a little bit under the weather this weekend, so I kind of followed that one through my phone, and then I listened to the review on Hammer's chat afterwards. That was probably the first match of the season that I've missed. I've been planning to watch it this week, so I really wanted to see how Ben Johnson got on at left back, but a lot of people's reviews from the match almost make me feel like I'm not too inclined to spend 90 minutes doing that. What about you guys?
Yeah, it was quite a dire game. What do you think, Jack?
Yeah, no, I thought we were, if I'm honest, quite poor, really. I think we just gave Villa too much space. We already looked like we'd sort of given up and were on holiday because we were safe. I didn't think we were that good at all, really.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think in my match report, I called us the Holiday Hammers, which surprised me a lot. I thought with the way we've been playing, we'd be looking to sort of push on a lot more and would have like just challenged for the final game of the season. Exactly, because there's only a short gap between this season and next season. It seemed a bit odd to see the momentum drop so quickly after confirming survival, but hey, we confirmed survival, we'll probably give them a little bit of slack for that game, but I think it's understandable that they probably took their foot off the pedal.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think now we should move on to our little Green Street Hammers season awards, I think would be the best way of calling it. I think we're going to start off with the signing of the season. I'm going to go to this you guys first. Jack, who would be your signing of the season?
My signing of the season, I think, has been Souček, just for the sheer impact he's had since joining. I don't think we would have stayed up if we didn't have him. Like, he's actually, I'd say, like almost completed our midfield, really. Like, he's perfect next to Rice. It allows Rice to push forward, maybe, as we've seen, score a decent goal. So he gets more, adds more to his game by Souček just being there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's been just immense since we've signed him. And he sort of seems like that player we've been screaming out to sign for the last couple of years. Like, a box-to-box midfielder. Originally, it was to be next to Mark Noble, but now it's next to Declan Rice, of someone that can be efficient in both ends of the pitch, and Souček's really great. Like, took that role with both hands, and he's just been incredible. What about you, Aaron?
I know we're often prone to being in consensus here, and as much as I'd like to go, you know, maybe with Jared Bowen to kind of mix things up, I think Souček has to be my signing of the year as well, for all the reasons that Jack mentioned. And I wrote that one article for Green Street talking about kind of like the leadership void that seems to have been there with West Ham over the past couple of years. And, you know, I think it was best epitomized when, you know, Souček got that goal disallowed, Chelsea came back and scored right away off a penalty, and we would have sunk our shoulders and, you know, kind of really just got run over in that match. But instead, he kind of, you know, took hold of that game and scored an equalizer. I think that kind of symbolized for me a lot of what he's brought to the table in terms of, you know, his leadership, how he plays. You know, he's that engine that just never stops. I think he's just been a complete game changer for the squad. What about you, Henry?
I'm probably going to have to go into consensus because sadly Roberto wasn't available to be voted for. But no, in all seriousness, Roberto is nowhere near for obvious reasons. I agree with you guys. I was thinking I'd say Bowen because of how much I wanted us to sign him and how well he has done.
Yeah.
But like, I agree, Suchek's impact in the middle of the park has just been immense. Bowen's been great on the wing and has created loads of chances, and I was unlucky not to have scored more than the one goal he has.
Yeah,
whereas
definitely.
Suchek, you feel like we maybe have been able to do similar things without Bowen, but without Suchek, we would have been nowhere near.
No.
Like, I think we're a much better team with Suchek in it without Bowen than Bowen without Suchek, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And we've also got Suchek for, like, what I think is an absolute bargain. It was somewhere between either 13.5 million to 17 million. That's an absolute steal.
Yeah, I think the total price of him goes to about 19 million.
And yeah,
if he'd been playing, but
in this day and age, when you think of a fact of, like, we paid more than that for Andre Ayew, you know, several seasons ago, you kind of compare it to that, and you're like, how are we able to get such a great player for such a low price? And I mean, I know some people a little more connected with the game who were aware of him because of how well he played for Slava Prague or the Czech against England, but I mean, for a lot of people, including myself, he was a relative unknown, and to come in and have the impact he had has been incredible. And I think it kind of shows sometimes we, as a club, trying to chase big names or big individuals who have kind of a lot of people know about, rather than trying to get a good player, which I think we've done there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the fact that he wasn't playing in one of the top leagues has really benefited us, because if he had been, a lot more people would have been aware of him, and we'd have faced a lot more competition to get him. So everyone else's loss is our game regarding Suchek, is the way I see it.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to move on to the next award, which I've decided will be the underappreciated player of the season. Now, I'm hoping there's a bit more debate over this one between us. Aaron, let's go to you first.
I know we all probably have a fair bit of recency bias just because of that long break before the last nine games of the season, but I thought pretty hard about this one, and I think I'm going to go with kind of one of my main guys, which is Rob Snodgrass. Like, I know he had no role to play in the last nine matches of the year, but prior to that, he was, you know, creating a lot of chances. He was the set-piece man. He scored some key goals, and he was a galvanizing force on the pitch for a team that was really not playing well, and it's, you know, obviously he hasn't played in a few months for us, but I do really think that he was still a key member of the team this year, that without him, we, you know, could have been in a lot more dire straits than we were.
Yeah, that's a really good shout. I'll get on to my one in a minute. Jack, what about you? Do you agree?
Yeah, I also said Snodgrass for all the reasons Aaron has said, but he's just been, like, he's been great for us really this season, like, leadership-wise, and his versatility as well. He can play either left or the right. He's sometimes played in a centre mid, I think, as well, or like it was a cam. And he's got 5 goals and 5 assists for us, and that's been quite crucial, really, especially the Brighton game where he ran the game, I think.
Oh, God damn it, guys. my underappreciated player of the season was also Robert Snodgrass.
Oh, dear.
I agree.
Oh, wow. I thought there was going to be a little bit of a discrepancy there, but I guess not.
No, yeah. I think some of the comments you hear about him from some of the fans, because he's not, his name's not, as Sam Allardyce would put it, Snodgrassinho or something. He's just sort of looked down upon because of where he's come from and the type of player he is. But people need to realise exactly how crucial the aspects he has to his game are for West Ham. The fact, Jack, you said he plays left or right, but what's really impressed me is how he's been in the centre, because of the way he doesn't stop running. And that's what West Ham fans love, is a player that will just keep going and going and going. And the amount of times he's popped up with a crucial goal, I was thinking, like, the Sheffield United game, which we drew at home, we did not look like scoring until the flick on, and Snodgrass, of all people, was the one breaking through. He was unlucky not to get the other goal at Sheffield United because of the Declan Rice handball. And I think he could have had a lot more. Yeah, exactly. But I feel like he could have had a lot more and looked a lot better statistically if he had a bit more luck around him. And everyone rates his left
under the, like, you know, if you think back to that Pellegrini era, which, you know, seems like so long ago, very much I would remark to people that West Ham looked like a club that was trying to pass the ball into the net sometimes. You know, we very rarely tested the keeper. And I guess, you know, Snodgrass kind of had that Yarmolenko quality about him that he, you know, he wasn't afraid to take a shot. He wasn't afraid to take an opportunity, even if it might look, make him look like a fool. And, you know, earlier in the year, that was kind of an aspect that we needed because nobody else was really doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. I think the only other player I had in my mind for the underappreciated award was going to be Andrei Yarmolenko. I feel like every season he gets a lot of slack because he had the 2 years he's been here, he's had a big injury at some point. So and then he all of a sudden he comes back and he looks a bit shaky here or there. And that's what people see in him rather than each season he's been here. He's been the main man at the start of the season. Last year, it was the two goals against Everton that helped us for our first win. And then this season, he scored a great goal against United, a great goal against Bournemouth. And he's got five in total, including the great memorable one against Chelsea. And everyone thinks of him as this like show pony that's not really putting in a lot of effort and this and that. But his minutes to goal contribution is really good. Like considering how injured he's been, and he is someone that I think, especially since the restart, he has shown a lot of passion for the club, which should be given a mention. Like the way he was after he scored the Chelsea goal, you could tell how much it meant to him, and he wanted to be the main man. And he knows it's maybe not gone the way we thought it would have gone for him, because a lot of people would have said if Yarmolenko was this good, he would have been in England 4 or 5 years ago. But we have seen flashes of that brilliance that has made Yarmolenko that desirable player that's meant he's won Ukrainian Player of the Year 4 times and is so well regarded back in his in Ukraine. So he's sort of, he'll be my other outside shout. I don't know if you guys have any special shout outs you want to go for players that might not have gone under the radar or so.
Before the break, I would have said Antonio because he wasn't like scoring many because he had like had 2 or 3 goals disallowed from VAR, I think. But he, when he played, he made a massive impact for us. Or like whether it being like on the wing or like up top with Haller, like his like directness and it's just pure like strength and the speed. It was like something we just didn't have.
Yeah, definitely. I always think about the game against Southampton, home and away, which is where we really saw the ability that they had to link up with each other.
Yeah,
and I mean, unfortunately, I think both times Antonio missed the one-on-one that he was put through for.
Yeah,
but yeah, he had 2 goals before the break, and obviously he's come back, took a couple games to get going, and then it's just exploded. And I think should be player of the month for July. If he's not, it would be a travesty. The
biggest robbery I've ever seen if he does not get that.
Yeah, my other player was Pablo Fornals. I think he got a lot of slack because a lot of people expect him to hit the ground running and was going to be this, but he's shown himself to do this like graft work. Like Aaron, I don't know, do you think Fornals as well?
That's actually who I was going to say. You know, I mean, it's, he's kind of been a guy who's been peaks and valleys too, right? I mean, there's been points of the year where fans have absolutely loved him. And then he's, you know, the last 9 games or so, he's been out on the left wing, clearly out of position. And, you know, at times his weaknesses have kind of shown there and people have forgotten about him. But he's made an effort to do things that maybe we wouldn't have expected from him, you know. And that Yarmolenko goal, he's the one who's busting into the box to, you know, create a diversion. He's been tracking back. He's been doing a lot of things that when, you know, sign him for £22 million, you don't necessarily expect that out of that type of player. So that was kind of my idea. But I was just a little with him, like there's also been times where fans have been absolutely in love with him. So it's like a weird different times in the season. He's been appreciated and underappreciated, I guess.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Like, he's had a bit of slack the last couple of weeks because he hasn't been getting forward, but he's basically having to be played as a second left back to cover for Cresswell. And the ability shown to sort of do that dirty work is remarkable from a player that you thought was going to be like a Lanzini replacement or so. That was just going to be signed for his attacking ability and the fact he had a lot of flair and like skill moves that you saw him have at Villarreal. But he's adapted his game to be this real grafter and, like as I said, like willing to do the dirty work and putting in tackles and contributing defensively, which I think is a lot of the reason we haven't conceded as much since the restart, because he's been covering ground that he shouldn't be having to, but doing it very well.
Yeah, I agree with that. I feel bad for him, really, because he has been like effectively having to cover Cresswell because he can't defend. And then also when Moyes came, like he was banging form, and then Moyes came in and just benched him for Lanzini for about a month, and he's just lost all his form.
Yeah, so exactly. And everyone was crying for him to come back out. And then what happened? He scored against Liverpool.
Exactly.
And just showed his class that he has going forward as well. And I think he's been living by himself in England. It's his first season here. He's still young. He's 24.
Young Spaniard coming in and adjusting to league. It's going to take time for him.
Yeah, he's got 2 goals, 5 assists. He's actually improved his statistical goal contribution from his last season at Villarreal. So for him, it has been a successful season going forward as much as it has been defensively for him. And I wrote an article about him earlier saying I think there's a lot more to come from him next season. Yeah, I know there's all the links with Eze and Benrahma at the moment in terms of like attacking midfielders, but if we're able to... My big theory about fixing West Ham at the moment is at the fullback positions. If we have a good back four, the license for these attacking players is a lot wider and they don't have to cover as much. And I think Fornals would flourish with the security that we have a left back capable of defending. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with a few more awards for the season.
For West Ham fans everywhere, this is the ultimate football app for you. For match highlights, interviews and the best West Ham videos and podcasts. Download the free COY Irons app now from the App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back to the Green Street Hammers podcast. We've just been talking about our underappreciated player of the season and signing of the season. And I think we're all agreeing it was Snodgrass and Souček, with a couple of shouts for Pablo Fornals and Yarmolenko as underappreciated. But now I want to know from Aaron and Jack what your young player of the season was. I'm going to go to Aaron first.
Yeah, it's a bit of a tough one, I guess, from the idea of where are we qualifying or having the cutoff for like a young player of the season. I guess the easy answer, especially with the last 9 games, would probably be someone like Ben Johnson. He's come in and played, 3 massive games and looked more and more comfortable each one and really been fantastic. I was also thinking, I guess, along the lines of, there's a very obvious choice, but I don't even know if we should include him in the young player of the year. But I was thinking maybe like a Pablo Fornals or something. I know he's about 24, but I guess Ben Johnson's kind of the easy answer if we're going to go that way.
Yeah, I think he's been great sort of taking that high pressure position of right back with Fredericks being injured, and especially the hole that we found ourselves in after Ngakia decided he wasn't going to be renewing his contract. So he had a lot of weight on his shoulders to step up and like show everyone why he was the higher rated right back. So I think I agree with your points there, Aaron. Jack, what about you? Who's your young player of the season?
See, I've gone for Declan Rice because of I think my player of the season deserves it and has been a bit underappreciated. So I've gone for Declan Rice as my young player of the season.
Yeah, I think Declan Rice is probably a very sensible shout for young player of the season with the way he has been. I mean, Declan, obviously, he's been unbelievable. I mean, topping off with the goal against Watford just sort of showed how good he was. And I think obviously everyone's sort of, we've come accustomed to Declan being in the squad now. So you don't think of him as that young player breaking through. You think he's more, because he's so established in the side and he plays with a sort of age beyond his years because he's so comfortable on the ball and he knows exactly where to be. He plays like he's got a lot more experience and he's a quality young player. And I think he's probably still the youngest in the squad, even younger than Ben Johnson, I think. Maybe he's a year older or so.
I think he's a year or two older than Johnson.
But exactly, I mean, Johnson's like the new young up-and-coming player and Declan Rice is only that much older than him. It shows how far he's come to be as highly rated as he is now. My choice was going to be Ben Johnson, mainly because I was sort of saying Declan's a bit too established. But I think you're okay there, Jack, with your choice. But Ben Johnson, he's come in, as I said, with all the weight on the shoulders of taking up the position. And not only has he shown he can do it at right back, he can do it at left back, and that's so important for West Ham to know they can rely on him there for next season, because at his current rate, Fredericks, is he going to Southampton? That's the talk. Cresswell, is he reliable? We're not sure about. Mazuaku is Mazuaku, and he could be off to wherever. I still think I think Mazuaku would be a very capable player in different leagues. But it's nice to know that we have the option of Ben Johnson, and I think he's deserving of like some sort of accolade for what he has done, even though he's only played a handful of games, he has shown why he was so highly rated in the academy.
Which is kind of funny that we offer the disclaimer that Johnson's only played a handful of games when we were all, you know, clamoring for the club. Not all of us, but we were discussing the Ngakia situation like so intensely when he had only really played four games. You know what I mean? It's kind of funny to make that comparison. Although I will admit the Ngakia situation really helped us to fill some time. We were doing this podcast week in, week out with no football being on.
It's the one thing I still like Ngakia for.
Yeah.
Moving on. This is a bit more of like maybe a personal one or so, but I want to know what everyone's favourite moment of the season was. I'm gonna go first this time, if that's all right, chaps.
Absolutely.
My favourite moment of the season was when Manuel Pellegrini finally understood the calls of the fans and dropped Roberto and put in David Martin for his debut against Chelsea. And he kept that clean sheet. And after the game, he ran off and hugged his dad. And it was sort of after all of the awfulness we'd had to deal with for the previous 2 months, it was sort of helped everyone sort of re-fall in love with West Ham and sort of see that sense of family that the team had. The way everyone was like giving David the pat on the back and congratulating how he played and everything. And the fact he topped it off with the clean sheet was just brilliant. So that was mine. What about you guys? Aaron.
That was definitely going to be one of my moments. I'm not sure if I've mentioned on this podcast before, I'm a former goalkeeper in hockey, and so that moment kind of had a lot of, and I have a very, very close relationship with my dad, who was, you know, kind of my mentor and my coach in that sense. So on top of even West Ham, I could really, like, when that moment happened and I saw him up in the stands, I made me think of my dad. There was a whole lot of emotions kind of swirling around that, and like you said, Henry, it really after a terrible couple months of football, it really helped to kind of remind us why we love West Ham. Beyond that, I guess another one of my key moments of the year was my mate and I had traveled over to watch the Liverpool away match. And, you know, we had spent the whole day having a few pints in Liverpool, and, you know, that sense of kind of nervousness about the game of we had traveled all the way over, let's just make this competitive. And I remember after they scored about, I think, 9 minutes in, and then we equalized, and then Pablo Fornals, I think Declan Rice crossed the ball in for him. Fornals one-timed it right into the net. And I just remember I was in the first row, and just that moment that goal went in and absolutely going limbs everywhere. That's kind of a pretty special moment. Obviously, the match didn't end how we wanted to, and it was a very lonely walk back to the city center. But that was really, really special. And then I guess if I'm going to pick another one that's kind of from Project Restart, I would say the moment that Yarmolenko goal went in to make it 3-2. I was watching on my in my back garden, and my wife's parents were over, and I had a beer in my hand, and I went pretty crazy, and I think they looked at me like I was an absolute lunatic. But it was it was the turning point of our year, I think, and it was very, very important.
Yeah, no, I agree. That the moment of Pablo Fornals scoring against Liverpool, even though I knew, I like deep down knew it wasn't going to end 2-1 to West Ham, but like the joy that moment gave, even though no one, I think, was confident that we'd still hold on. But no, in that moment of celebration, that was euphoric. And it was sort of I think that was one of the moments that showed that we were starting to turn the tide. Even though we didn't get the result from that game, it was sort of, it showed that we had still had something to give and that we weren't going to go down without a fight. And then we saw, I don't know if it was the next game or the game after, when Southampton came up and we got that final win. I think it might have been 2 games later, and we had that horrific 3-3 draw against Brighton.
Oh, yeah.
It showed that we weren't going down without a fight. So that was a good moment. Jack, what about you?
So I'm going to say for my first one, at the start of the season when we beat Man United 2-0, when that Cresswell's free kick went in, I honestly thought we were going to get Champions League. Right, so I was very excited. Obviously, I was let down quite significantly later on. But I'd say my second one for like post-lockdown, it'd probably be, you know, the moment Declan Rice's goal like hit the back of the net. Like, I just knew we were staying up then. I just knew we were.
Yeah,
was pretty good.
Yeah, it was a great goal from Declan. I was at the game against United when Cresswell put that in, and I think a lot of people forgot how well we started the season. And it was sort of it all sort of started to collapse around Fabianski's injury and the 4-0 away loss to Oxford.
Yeah.
But like the first six games, I think we'd won three, lost two, drawn one, or roughly around that. We'd won three of our first six or so, and there was a real positivity around the place that we were going to build on that 10th place finish from last season and like be competitive and be pushing 9th, 8th, 7th, maybe 6th, or as you say, Champions League. But it just showed how that injury to Fabianski, it just shattered the team, and Pellegrini lost his job, and then Moyes came back and we beat Bournemouth 4-0. That was another favourite moment of mine. Just all of the despair around Moyes coming back, and then the first game he won 4-0, and that sort of infamous press conference of David Moyes saying, "That's what I do, I'll win." I apologise for my Scottish accent, but every time we do well, I play it to myself and just have a little chuckle. Or even if we lose, I play it to myself and have a bigger chuckle and a little cry.
I started planning that trip to Anfield, and then to go to the Southampton at home match at the end of that Manchester United victory. So the situation had changed drastically by the time I boarded my flight. It went from like expecting us to go rampaging into Liverpool and, you know, and beating them and being right up in the top six to just like being an absolute shambles. So it's pretty classic West Ham for sure.
Yeah, you can never get a guarantee from West Ham, and that's one thing for certain.
Yeah.
Right, so I think that brings us nicely on to the match of the season. And Aaron, do you want to take the lead on this one?
Yeah, it's I guess a bit of a tough one. I kind of have to go again with one of my moments, which was probably that Chelsea victory when Yarmolenko scored at the end. I think that game just had it all. They had, like I mentioned earlier about Souček and his leadership, you know, West Ham got that early key goal that was suddenly taken away by VAR controversially. They came down the pitch, and like I just knew, as I'm sure you guys did, once that goal was disallowed, that Chelsea was going to get the next one. There was no doubt in my mind, and I felt it went in, and my father-in-law was sitting with me, and like he just kind of looked at me, and I couldn't even talk. I just kind of was already starting to worry about relegation. I felt that we scored right before half, and then, you know, to go out and take the lead, and then that, you know, the free kick, and then to win it at the end. It just, for me, it was such a, you know, a crazy bout of emotions, and, you know, with the amount of stress of a, you know, a relegation battle and the way we had kind of played the previous game. And it just kind of, everything kind of made it the perfect match in that sense. But I mean, there's a lot of other great ones. What do you guys think?
Yeah, Jack, feel free to carry it on.
I've also gone for the 3-2 win against Chelsea. That was probably one of the biggest games, like I'd say, since I moved there, other than the Watford game. And it was also quite special. We did the double over Chelsea then as well. It was the fashion we won, like last minute breakaway goal. And it was quite typical that it was Yarmolenko who's been getting sort of slated quite a lot. It was good to see him score as well.
Yeah, especially in sort of his typical fashion of cutting in on his left and putting it into the far corner. I think Rudiger must have been the only person in the world not knowing what he was going to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. He had a howler of a match for sure.
Yeah.
I also have a good moment from that game. I don't know if you noticed or not, but after we scored the third goal, I think there's a video of Ogbonna taking the mick out of Kepa.
Oh no, I saw that. I can't remember what
he
said.
That's on the behind the access video, and he's like, I mean, I don't know the broadcast you guys get over in the UK, but over here I was listening to one with the sound piped in, but this was obviously like a very quiet stadium, and he's just like yelling at him, and you can hear it like across the entire field making fun of him. It was kind of unexpected from Ogbonna. I don't know why. What do we really know about these guys' personalities when they're playing a game? But it was, I had a good laugh about it.
Yeah, so did I.
Yeah, I'd also had written the Chelsea 3-2 for all of the reasons you guys have said, but I'm actually going to sort of change my thinking about it, and sort of basing on this the fact from my girlfriend, if people don't know, she is from Nottingham and is from a Nottingham Forest family, so they had to sort of deal with the unlikely goal swing that happened that cost them the playoff spot. So my match of the season is actually going to be quite a drab 1-1 draw with Manchester United. Just for the fact that even though we thought and we knew we were basically safe, and everyone was saying, oh, we're safe, and that you'd have to remind us, like, it's not mathematical yet. If anyone in the league can throw away a 13-goal lead against Manchester United and Aston Villa, it's West Ham. Yeah. And the fact, like, we got the point that we needed, and that was brilliant. And you can sort of see the relief drain from the players that they knew they'd done it. You also had Antonio getting his 10th goal of the season, his best ever goal scoring season since, I think, he's joined West Ham, maybe since time began, I don't know. But
yeah, I think he got 9 goals in the 16-17 season. But yeah. he had got injured for the last 2 months, I think.
Yeah,
so yeah, I think he had like 8 headers that year too. It was like nothing was scored with his feet, or maybe 1 goal was scored with his feet or something along those lines. It was crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's always great when we finally get a player who does reach double digits, because it doesn't happen a lot. And
no,
it was a shame we didn't really hold on to the win, but it was sort of the one moment of magic from that game from Mason Greenwood equalizing. Yeah,
I think, to divert as well, if I could pick a second match I really enjoyed, I was obviously at it, the 3-1 win against Southampton. It's really tough to plan a trip overseas, and all you really hope is that West Ham's competitive and shows up, and you don't go to a game where suddenly you give up 3 terrible goals in the first 20 minutes and you basically just can't wait to get to have pints at halftime. So I really, that match was great. I went to like the pre-match event, met Ludwig McClusko, and then we went over to the ground, and like, it was just the atmosphere. Everybody knew it was like a must win. And, for Bowen to get his first goal and get off the mark, it was just like, just a really fantastic atmosphere that day. So it kind of makes it one of my favorites of the year as well.
Yeah, it was a great game, especially sort of, we saw the best of Haller in that game. Like him showing fight for his goal and the way flicked it on to Antonio throughout the game. Like, yeah, that was a great game. But also going back to the United game, there was also a moment I wanted to talk about was after we'd scored what was an obvious penalty, which seemed to take a year to be decided on VAR, of Paul Pogba's handball.
I thought they weren't going to give it.
Yeah, exactly. And the moment that Antonio is jesting with Bruno Fernandes about it, and then the camera just focuses on this miserable face in the background, and it realises it's Paul Pogba. Just looking furious at this £7 million player from Nottingham Forest that is a utility player that's just sort of burst onto the scene and it's been amazing, sort of slagging him off. And then you just sort of see Antonio pull that face where he knows he's been heard by someone that shouldn't have heard him.
Yeah.
And he's just sort of grinning at the camera, even though he's still out of focus, you know what he's doing. So despite it being quite a relatively poor match, it was probably my favourite of the season because it's what kept us up, really.
Yeah.
And I also like to say the Norwich game where Antonio scoring 4 goals. That
I could not believe it.
West Ham don't get hat tricks, let alone a player scoring 4 goals.
Yeah. And that was the first hat trick we've scored since
Andy Carroll.
Carroll's against Arsenal.
Yeah. It's the first hat trick we've had since we've moved.
Yeah.
Even though we've had a game which we won 8-0, it's the first hat trick we've had.
Yeah.
So that's definitely a special moment as well. Right, we're going to take another break and we'll be back for the final part in a minute. Welcome back to the Green Street Hammers podcast. It's part 3. We've already discussed a lot of our favourite moments and players of the season, but now we're going to move on to the goal of the season. And this is always something that I think people have a lot of different views on, whether or not it's spectacular or the importance of the goal. So hopefully we do have some disagreement and debate rather than sort of all agreeing for once. Aaron, what was your favorite goal of the season?
Well, I mean, my first one, which I feel like we're all going to have a consensus on, was probably Declan Rice's goal against Watford, just for the significance of it, how beautifully he took it, and just that sheer feeling of going up 3-0 and everything. And I thought that was probably my goal of the season, but I have a feeling we all might potentially agree on it, so I might go back to brainstorming a little more while you guys name yours.
All right, Jack.
Okay. Yes, so I had two. I couldn't decide really between them, but they're both good goals, but they're both very different. So obviously my first option was Declan Rice's absolute worldie against Watford, for obvious reasons. But then my second one was Haller's, well, I don't know what it was. It wasn't a bicycle kick or a scissor. It was just more of a scissor kick against Bournemouth in the 4-0 win.
Yeah, that was a great moment.
Really good goal. And I'm a big fan of Haller, so it was like good to see him getting back to scoring, especially a good goal.
Yeah, that was a really, really good goal. Really well taken. It sort of went a bit under the radar, I think.
Yeah, I think it has
when it happened. My to be honest, my personal favourite goal, I think you've actually already mentioned, was Aaron Cresswell's free kick against Manchester United.
Oh, yeah.
I usually sat like right above that goal in the Bobby Moore stand. And yeah. I think he had one about 5 minutes earlier that went straight into the wall.
Yeah. And but then, I think there was one he just missed, I think.
Yeah.
It was and then quite the narrow, yeah.
Yeah, and then the second one, he got it perfect and it went straight into the top corner. And like as you said, like the positivity we had coming away from that game, beating United 2-0, and I think that passed to fifth or something in the league.
Yeah.
Like so for me, that was my favourite goal of the season. But more so for importance, I'd probably put it down to Yarmolenko's as well. So for the spectacular reason, I'd probably go with Cresswell's. But in terms of importance, Yarmolenko's against Chelsea. How are you doing, Aaron? Have you come up with one?
I was trying to remember. I think it might have been a goal in Roberto's first start to put us up 1-0, where I kind of felt like, you know, maybe we'll be okay. I think Haller ended up finishing it. It wasn't like some fantastic finish. It was just passed to him in the box, and he like put it in. But I think almost everybody touched it in the build up or something along those ways. But I don't know if you guys remember the one I'm talking about.
That was against Crystal Palace, wasn't it?
Against Palace, yeah. And then they ended up scoring a penalty and then scoring a late winner that kind of, you know, where Roberto's... I thought, you know, we might have been okay with him and, you know, it'd be great to get him off the mark with, like, a clean sheet, and then it kind of fell apart at the end. But I don't remember a lot of details about that goal fully, but I remember it just being, like, a fantastic build-up where, you know, many players touched the ball and we really, really moved it around. But beyond that, I don't have much.
Yeah, no, that was a great team goal. I've also just thought of a couple others, and I think back to Haller's one, his second goal for the club, the overhead kick against Watford. But also the goal that almost happened where he sort of scorpion kicked it, or like some sort of flick in that game that just sort of, I can't remember if it just fell for Foster or it hit the bar or something.
Yeah, I think Foster just saved it. Like, it was like a scorpion kick overhead. It was mental. Yeah, I had no idea how he did it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think another goal that's gone really under the radar because we lost the game was Snodgrass's volley from the edge of the box against Newcastle. Like, he just took it so well, cleanly, and it flew into the bottom corner. And also Antonio's against Tottenham that we lost, and he sort of swiveled and just fell as he hit it, and it just flew past Lloris, and all of a sudden you thought maybe we'll get something from the game, but sadly we didn't. Like, there was that run of games of the 3-2 against Tottenham and 3-2 against Newcastle. We actually scored some good goals, but the defence was just too poor to get anything from the game. So we have scored some good goals this season, but so what are we deciding is our goal of the season? Oh, silence.
That's a tough one, I guess. I mean, I really like the Declan Rice one just because of the sheer significance of it, but I don't know if that's kind of how we want to conclude it with like the difficulty level or just the actual beauty of the goal, because then I think it's that, then Cresswell's is phenomenal. Mm. But otherwise, if you think about the importance of the game and the player who scored it, I'd go with Declan Rice.
Yeah, I think Declan's has a bit of everything in it. What about
you, Jack? It was a great strike and it was a very significant goal for us.
Yeah, so I think Declan Rice against Watford. He hasn't had young player of the season, so we'll give him goal of the season.
Yeah.
And that should sort of make him feel better and wanted at the club and stay forever.
Yeah. Please stay, Declan. Don't leave.
Yeah, so now the big one is the player of the season. I think there was two very clear options. Well, to me there was. I want to know what you guys think. Jack, I'll come to you first.
I think I've gone for what most of us are going to go for, and I've gone for Ogbonna. I think he's been absolutely like rock solid for us. We would be in a lot of trouble without him, really. I don't think he does go quite under the radar, really. He's been a great servant for us. Like, he's been here five, six seasons now, and like he's been great for us. He scored some important goals, and he's just been rock solid at the back.
Yeah, that's some very good points. Aaron?
Yeah, there was a reason that I left Declan Rice out of my young player of the year. It's because I think for me personally, it was far and away the hammer of the year and the player of the year on our podcast. I just, you know, it's so easy to get sometimes awarding these things to feel kind of creative or not, you know, feel like because Rice is a bit younger or he hasn't been here, you know, maybe as long as like an Ogbonna. But I don't see any way that West Ham competes or even stays up without him this season. Every minute in the Premier League, you know, what he does on the pitch, the leadership, the fact that he seemingly gets better week in, week out. Like, he came back from that, from the lockdown, and looked like he had, you know, put some, a little more bulk on his frame. He was out muscling players. He was, you know, scoring goals. He was getting forward. I just think he's been fantastic. He seems like he's an absolute coach's dream. He's growing into being a vocal leader. I mean, I'm not putting a sales pitch for any other team out there, because they know all those things too. But I just think for me, he's, you know, maybe we want to not award it to him because he's a bit of a youngster still, but I think hands down, he's my player of the year.
Yeah, some great points. I mean, my thought was Ogbonna as well. I mean, like you guys have said, he's just been brilliant at the back. And I think sort of it's almost been more impressive how good he's been by the fact he's had to cover for Anissa Diop, that's not been at top form as he was the season before. He's had to cover for Cresswell a lot. And also because of our issues at right back, he's almost had to do that job as well. So the fact he's almost been a whole defence for us and has done it brilliantly, it just shows he needs a bit more help to be supported next season to carry it on, especially as he is ageing. But I think he definitely deserves some recognition for how well he has played. I mean, Declan Rice even said Ogbonna was his player of the season. So if the player of the season by the club is saying someone else's player of the season, that's quite good to go on for Angelo. And he's been absolutely brilliant. And I agree, Declan Rice is just as sort of certified to be player of the season. But I think Ogbonna sort of almost deserved a co-player of the season award for how good he had been. And I think he people forget how often he does pop up with a goal from a corner or something as well for a centre-back. He goes under the radar with the amount of goals he scored throughout his time at West Ham, especially important goals. I always think back to the one against Liverpool in the end season. That was just a great moment. We never have a defender that scores regularly, but I think he's the closest we've had to it of someone that you can maybe back that is going to get his head onto the ball from the corner and find a goal with it. So for me, it was Ogbonna. So I think we're all agreed on Ogbonna for the Green Street Hammers player of the season.
I can go with that. I can get along with that.
Yeah, you're okay to go with that?
I mean, he was a close second in my kind of personal little poll, and I'm sure he was very much so for the club's voting as well. So it's not like I'm disagreeing strongly with it. I love Declan Rice. I think he's been great.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think both are very, very capable. Maybe we'll give out a player of the season awards. So neither of them.
If I could give it to both, I would give it to both. Yeah,
I think you're right. I mean, they both make the team so much better when they play. As we've got a little bit more time to kill into the podcast, and the transfer window is open, and it already seems like it's been open for about a month by the amount of stories we've been hearing left, right and centre. I want to get your guys, if you could sign one of the players we've been linked with, or maybe someone we haven't been linked with yet, who your top transfer target will be. I'm going to go to Aaron first.
Yeah, I think basically I don't necessarily have like a top transfer target, but I do think the most important positions that we need to upgrade on in the transfer window is, you know, everybody wants, I'm not saying that Eze wouldn't be like a great signing, or Benrahma from Brentford, I believe that's his name, but I just think there has to be an upgrade at the left back and right back position, whoever that ends up being, whether it's, you know, Anthony Robinson, is it from Wigan or someone along those lines. I don't think as a club we can go into next season with the players we currently have in those positions. And if it doesn't really matter who else we bring in, you know, on the attacking side, if those positions aren't upgraded, then it's kind of all for naught, in my opinion, because we're in the exact same position that we found ourselves, you know, this year. We had all kinds of attacking talent, especially, you know, at the start of the year when some certain players were playing better. But I mean, it have to become a more balanced squad. And I think upgrading those positions with, you know, there's numerous targets at each one. I do think Ben Johnson will, you know, help to fill one of those sides and play a fair share of games, but there has to be more turnover than that. You guys might have a few more specific targets, though.
Yeah, Jack, what about you?
I completely agree that we definitely need to get in two new fullbacks. Like, Cresswell, in my opinion, has been shocking recently. And hopefully Ben Johnson does step up, but I think we need someone to push him because I think Fredericks might get sold this summer. So, but otherwise, apart from that, like, I think a top chance for Target Rush should be Eze, because I just think he's going to become like a world-class player. He looks the real deal. And I think we might as well like get him now for a good price and get one of our strikers off the books in Hugill. It brings the price down even lower because it'd just be a great investment. Obviously, we need to do the defence as well. Maybe, I think, Anthony Robinson or Ryan Manning at left back. And we've also been linked with Non-TL at right back. I don't know if that's happening anymore because apparently it's not a priority. But I would say Eze to be my main transfer target.
Yeah, I think you guys both make great points. Obviously, Eze seems to be the man of the hour at the moment. I know David Moyes has gone and watched him plenty of times. He played at the London Stadium before football restarted, and we can use Hugo as the make weight to make our offer a bit more favourable than Crystal Palace, who I think is the main rival in signing him. Yeah. So as like top transfer targets go, I agree, like, he is right up there, but I've got to side with Aaron, and there needs to be huge investment into the fullbacks. Like, I was talking to someone earlier saying, in terms of going forward, I think we've got great firepower potentially there, and what it needs to be helped to unlock it is the foundations of a good back four, which we don't have at the moment because of the failings at left and right back.
Yeah,
and if Ben Johnson is the player that can step up and take right back, which means we don't have to sign Gonçalo Montiel or Matty Cash from Forest, then that's great. I mean, I don't want to just see the club just spend money for the sake of it. If they've got the option, then you don't need to do it. I would like to see someone come in and challenge if Fredericks is sold for Southampton, because if any offer comes in for him, the club will make profit on him. So if he was to go, I'd like to see if maybe we could try, say, to Tottenham, can we have Walker-Peters on loan for that right-back competition? But left-back for me is the main concern, because every week it was becoming, is it Cresswell or Masuaku? Well, if it's Masuaku, at least we maybe have some skills going forward, but and maybe a bit more defensive solidity, but he's more accident prone, whereas Cresswell's just been poor all season, bar the first few months or so where he was chipping in with goals at least. So my top transfer target would probably be Anthony Robinson from Wigan, especially if we can get him on this deal that we might be able to do. The other person I've seen that we have been linked to the club, but it's gone a bit quiet, is the Atalanta fullback, Timothy Castagne. I think I'm saying it right. He can play left and right back. His contract's running out at the end of next season. He's only 24. I know I wrote an article about him. A lot of people said, why would he leave Atalanta? Well, the answer is they don't play with fullbacks. He's been playing in a position that's not too natural as a more advanced left wing back or left wing back, because they play with a back three. So I know West Ham will be able to offer him more wages than Atalanta are paying him, because they don't have the biggest budget. So I do think there's a potential deal there for a player that might want to play more, because he's only played 25 games or so for them this season. They've had a very long season with Champions League football and the Italian Coppa Italia and the league that they've done so well in the season. So surely you can say to him, well, we can pay you double what you're on, and you're going to be playing week in, week out as long as you're not injured. And if he can play left and right back to equal skill level, it almost solves two pieces of the puzzle with one piece. If he can cover either side when needs be, if, say, Cresswell does stay but and he's on all right form, but Johnson gets injured, then he can just swap over. So that would be my top transfer target.
Even imagine having, you know, Ben Johnson and is it Castagne that you butchered his name, but like, you know, if you have two players who have that type of flexibility, that only makes you better as a team as well, right? Like, you can, you know, right now, where, you know,
you can swap them about for whatever team you're playing against. So yeah, if one of them's fast,
whoever's maybe on form, and you know, like this year at one point, like if Ryan Fredericks and, you know, bless him, Pablo Zavaleta, who was, you know, it was clear he was near the end, and like those were your two options. Whereas the, you know, you have two players who can kind of switch sides or can come into the lineup where you need them or where there's injuries. That I think that only makes you better as a squad. Kind of, I guess in a way, like we talked about Snodgrass having that flexibility. Like the more players you have with that type of talent is helpful.
Yeah, exactly. And you could tailor the starting 11 to the team that you're playing against. So, for example, if we were playing Newcastle next year, and you know St. Maximum is going to be up on the left wing, right wing, or what?
I think it's right.
Right wing.
No, he's left. He's left wing.
Left wing. If he's going to be up on the left wing, you can. Yeah, if he's on the left wing, then you can put the faster one of the two up against him, so you know the person's got the best chance of keeping up with him, and then the other player can have the duty of taking care of the other side because he might not be as quick. But if you're coming up against someone stronger, you can put the stronger, physically stronger player to counteract that. So you get a lot of options if you have players that can play on both sides of the pitch, especially in the fullback areas.
Yeah.
Oh, I do think it's...
Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, I do think it's going to be an interesting time on West Ham Twitter during the transfer window, because it's pretty obvious the club's not going to be spending a lot of money, and I think there's going to be a lot of, you know, fairly upset people. But I'm kind of the opinion they don't have to go, you know, absolutely, like, not that they have the capabilities to, but that Pellegrini's first kind of transfer window where they spent money like crazy. I think there's a few tweaks and a few players that can be brought in, and I really actually... You know, I know we only finished 16th, but I think the nucleus of the squad the past month and a bit really showed that they are capable of competing especially if they're, you know, we tweak a few positions.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to know if you guys agree with this. The majority of West Ham's revenue, the way I see it, is built up from the TV money, the fact we don't have to pay too much money for the stadium, and prize money from the Premier League. And the match day income for most clubs in the Premier League is actually a relatively small percentage of the revenue brought in each year. So do you think these whole stories that the fact there's no money might be a bit of a negotiating tactic? I mean, we've said it before that there's only this amount of money, and then we've gone and spent a lot more than what we've said there was. I think it was Pellegrini's first season, we were saying, oh, there's only £40 million for him. And then we spent close to £100 million on Anderson and everyone else that came in then. So do you reckon maybe it's a bit of a negotiation tactic, or is there really nothing left in the pot?
No, yeah, I would say it probably is, really. I refuse to believe that we're skin. I don't believe it. We're supposedly the 18th richest club in the world, and yet we supposedly can't. We have to sell players. I don't believe it.
Yeah, I think it might be a way of trying to sort of present the fact that, yes, we might have to lose Anderson or Haller in order to fund the players that you guys have all been saying that you want on Twitter and everything. And also the stories that we're behind on the payments on Haller, which I don't know how... I think Gold and Sullivan are a lot of things, but I don't think they're stupid to allow something like that that could incur punishment. I don't think they'd be that silly to make a decision like that, especially knowingly, because it's not something you forget of, oh, we need to pay this club £5 million next month. I think that's something that sticks in your mind.
They would never forget when somebody owes them £5 million, right? So I highly doubt that they forget. I agree with you guys too. I think it's, like you said, the match day actual income doesn't bring in all that much these days. I think it's just basically, you know, they always put out the same propaganda, and it generally is propaganda, you know, through Claret and Hugh, who is kind of their unofficial kind of you know, press team. And I remember reading last year, the year before, that the actual increase in revenue between moving from the London Stadium from Upton Park was really not that much. It wasn't even enough to buy a quality player. So I mean,
yeah, it was negligible.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that just shows us right off the bat how you know, how little money they actually take in from ticket sales and stuff like that. And I mean, one's a billionaire, the other one's not too far off, I don't think. I think maybe the club and its coffers doesn't have a ton of money at the moment. Yeah. But if they actually want to, you know, David Gold, 442 Green Street or whatever, actually wants to show how much he loves the club, instead of talking about that, he could, you know, maybe put a little bit of his own money into that. I know they're not, I've read before, they're not the most cash rich individuals, you know, like, yeah, one's a billionaire, but he, so much as that is owned in property. I don't know how much that's been affected by the COVID and everything like that. But I mean, I generally think if there was a way for them to try to win back over the fans, it would be to surprise us all and maybe spend some money when we didn't think they would. But I don't actually expect that'll happen.
No, I don't understand how you can be, say, like a Premier League, like own a Premier League club and just not really put a penny into it. It just doesn't make sense to me. Like, you want those more, you want to like spend decent money on decent players, whereas they always seem to look like, usually up until like recently, for like the cheapest options.
Or the ones, yeah, they know the right agent, as Henry's pointed out several times. I think it's also, I've read a book, I forget the exact name of it, but it's about, you know, football in modern Britain and the change of the game and everything. And it kind of talks about the, you know, the idea that any business person who gets into buying a football club expecting to actually make money is an absolute fool. You know, it's not a business you buy to, like you would buy any other business. It is basically a vanity project where you buy it because it, you know, makes you look good, or you can brag about owning West Ham United Football Club.
Yeah.
So like for them to suddenly want to try and turn it into a legitimate business, it's just kind of, you know, bullshit for a lack of other words. Like, they need to recognize that what they bought was a vanity project and, you know, spend some money really.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we could talk about this for a good while longer, our own conspiracy theories around the board. But no, I think I agree with you guys. I fail to see why the fact of COVID's going to have affected the revenue from the club in total, because the TV companies have said they're going to follow through with the contracts. That money's still going to come. The money from the Premier League is still going to come. So a large proportion of the West Ham revenue is still there. And they haven't had any costs in terms of actually having to really steward the stadium well, because there's been no fans to steward.
I was going to say, they always complain about how expensive it is, especially after that infamous Burnley match, how expensive it is to host matches and stuff now. Well, they haven't had to worry about that, right?
It's exactly. And if we do sort of follow through with this culling the Pellegrini era and selling the big players on big money, and we're replacing them with a Benrahma or an Eze or a Manning or Montiel or a Matty Cash or Joe Worrall, whoever they are, their wages are going to be so, so far lower than what Anderson's and Haller's and Lanzini's are. So you're saving money in that respect every week. It's just the initial outlay, and deals are staggered over 3, 4, 5 years. So it's not like we need to find £60 million tomorrow in order to fund these moves. It's all about how you plan the transfers out and are able to pay for them over the future. It's not like, it's very rare a club will like demand the £20 million cash on the door tomorrow. It's very rare that deal actually happens, unless it's something particular the club is desperately in need of it, because they like receiving the money over a period of time as well, because it makes their books look better. Saying, knowing each time they come to doing their books, there's £5 million from there, and there's £12 million from there, and there's this and this and this, rather than going, oh, we haven't sold anyone this year, there's nothing coming in in terms of other than prize money and TV money. So there's a lot of things. I think we're going to have to end it there, guys, otherwise we're going to be running over by a long way.
Absolutely.
So thank you very much for joining me, Jack and Aaron.
It was a pleasure.
Yep, it's been great.
And from the rest of us at Green Street Hammers, come on, you Irons.